Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, everybody, and thanks for joining me, Zoe, from Zoe Discovers once again. Welcome back to another episode of Discover North Korea, the podcast where I talk about everything you've never heard about or know of from North Korea. Today's going to be a little bit different because today I am actually not playing host. I am playing interviewee. Stanley from Safety Last Podcast kindly invited me on his show a few weeks back. We had a great and pretty long chat about all things North Korea, and I really appreciated his respect whilst at the same time pushing me a little bit for some political debate whilst we were answering the questions. I find that I tend to get a little bit more open and indeed political when encouraged by others, and some of the questions Stanley asked, I'm sure, are questions that you might have on your mind too. I also thoroughly enjoyed the myth busting we went through at the end of the episode, so make sure to stick around for that. In fact, I might do a whole episode on that in the future. I thought you might enjoy the episode, so I uploaded it here this week as well. Enjoy, and thanks again to Stanley for having me, as well as for producing and sending me this episode to upload here. You can find Stanley's podcast, Safety Last, on all your podcast platforms, like the one you're listening to from here, and the information is also in the show notes. Thank you very much, and enjoy!
North Korea is a country that everyone has an opinion on, but no one has any experience of. Throughout my entire life, this rogue state has been painted with the worst possible portrayals, linked with human rights violation, poverty, a closed-off political system that no foreigner can seem to understand, and perhaps most damaging, a loose trigger finger with nuclear weapons. So, just imagine my surprise when I found a Westerner who hasn't just entered North Korea. She's done it multiple times, and now works for a travel agency in North Korea. This means I finally have access to a place that previously seemed impenetrable. Does North Korea only allow a certain number of haircuts? Are blue jeans really banned? And what are the poverty levels like? I've also been told by South Koreans that Koreans that can speak English would be kidnapped and then forced to teach English in North Korea. So many questions, so little time. After listening to this podcast, I realized that some people might feel that I didn't talk about the political situation enough, and that I was too lenient with Zoe by not pushing her harder to discuss the actions of the North Korean government. And while I think these criticisms are fair, when I first contacted Zoe, she stated that she generally tries to avoid the most politically sensitive parts of the country. This is probably because of her employment, but also because she doesn't have an interest in these fields. And while I didn't push these topics, I don't think I shied away from it either. I do ask questions about the DMZ, how North Korea sees the South, and what are some things that you can and can't do or say in the country. Ultimately, I think Zoe's goal is to humanize the citizens of North Korea. not as political pawns in a geopolitical struggle with Western democratic and capitalist countries, but people just like us. I hope you enjoy this podcast. A lot of my preconceptions about North Korea were broken, and some of my older expectations were reinforced. But how often do you get a chance to peer behind the curtain? Enjoy. Hey everyone, welcome to Safety Last, and today we have a very special, I guess you could use the word strange, like it's unexpected, I would say, our guest joining us today, and I'll briefly jump into that in a moment. But yeah, Zoe, would you like to just introduce yourself and tell us a little about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I mean, my name's Zoe. I am British, living in Taiwan at the moment, doing my PhD, and I guess, you might be most interested to know, I mean, your listeners, why I'm here today is probably most interesting, my previous job and also what I hope to keep doing once the borders open from COVID-19 is I was a tour guide in North Korea. So that means I was in and out of North Korea a lot. And since the borders have been closed, I've been keeping all of that up on social media. So I've been making videos and stuff on North Korea.
And I'll just to let the audience know how I actually stumbled across your channel. Have you actually watched the film JSA by any chance?
I have, yes.
Yeah. Okay. To the audience, if you have not watched the film, I highly, highly recommend it. It's a very, very famous Korean film. It's also by the same director who did The Handmaiden in 2016. If you've ever watched that, Zoe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have actually.
Okay. Well, Yeah, it's amazing. I love both films. JSA, Joint Security Area. Basically, if I can talk about the film for 5 seconds without giving away the plot, North Korean and South Korean soldiers befriend each other, and then, I guess, things happen after that, to say the very least. But I watched the film, and I was just so intrigued. And often when I finish watching a film and I'm really a fan of it, I'll go on YouTube and I'll find like other resources to read up on articles or just information about it. And when I typed in JSA, and another reason I did this was because I was going to go to Korea and I plan to visit the DMZ as well. So I guess that a DMZ by anyone, just in case you don't know, is the line between North and South Korea. I guess it's called the Demilitarized Zone. And yeah, and after typing in JSA and just looking at trailers and other information and stuff like that, I stumbled across your channel, Zoe. And the thing that caught my eye was there was you in the profile photo of one of the thumbnails. And, you know, I'm pretty sure you're blonde. And next to you, you were standing like a North Korean soldier or something. And I'd never seen that combination in my life. Like, and my immediate reaction was like, is this like a Photoshop? Like, I'm actually not sure if this is true. So immediately when I saw that and the title was like something to the extent of like, you know, traveling around North Korea or, you know, British tour guide in North Korea or something to that extent, I was like, no way. So I clicked it and I actually watched a few videos. And after that, I guess I reached out to you.
Yeah, it's funny because like that picture, I think is so, I mean, it's so iconic. And like, it's funny when you're creating content and stuff, you don't know what is going to be picked up by the majority of the audience a lot of the time. And so, you know, I'd made quite a few videos before this and they got like, you know, a few thousand views and stuff. And, you know, the image that you're talking from is basically a screenshot of me doing an interview with one of the military guards at the DMZ. With like one of the military soldiers, like he takes people around as well. And it's one of the few places that you can take a picture of. And that picture is just a screen grab of me like doing an interview with him. We're just laughing and stuff like that. And I didn't even think much of that when I was going through the footage and editing the video. I then made a video that's like, you know, is it really that scary to visit the DMZ? And I decided to make it the thumbnail, but it wasn't going to be my first choice. And I think like but that image, like it really made that video take off because like you said, like it's not something that a lot of people had seen before. And I genuinely think like without that thumbnail image, I really don't think that anything would have got that big because that video ended up getting like, I mean, it's on like 1.5 million views now. Like it's nothing compared
like my other videos are nothing compared to it. So I think, yeah, just everyone's used to seeing, like someone commented actually that it's the first time they ever saw a North Korean soldier smile or a North Korean smile, you know, and that left such a big impact on me. Like, you know, the first time you see a North Korean smile, it's not the first time they've ever smiled, you know?
And I actually did end up going to the DMZ, and there's this place that you can go in from South Korea where you can look through telescopes and you can look into the North Korean side. And basically, I guess this might be a theme, because we don't hear anything about North Korea. Like, we were just looking at farms and we're like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, because we just, it's like, as the nickname suggests, it's the Hermit Kingdom. It's basically so isolated culturally, like maybe not physically, but regardless, like, we hear very little news from that place. And yeah, I think maybe to your point, like, even mundane things gets transformed into something like bizarre and strange because it has that North Korean label. But just to go over, I guess, some of your history, let me know if this is correct, and maybe we can find out why exactly you started, I guess, doing these guides in North Korea, a place which, you know, when we think of like K-pop and stuff, like that's really the main draw to like South Korea. Like, you don't usually hear many people being drawn to the North, but basically, from what I've gathered, you did a exchange in Japan, and from what I heard, you said you introduced yourself as like English or British, and then a lot of people said like, oh, it's so dangerous in England, or it's so dangerous in Britain, and because of that, you were very shocked that as someone who came from that area, you were so taken aback that this is what people thought, and then your reaction to that was, this must be the media. And then that transformed into, well, what's somewhere very scary that I can go and actually have a look for myself. And then that eventually led to homestay in Korea. And then I think, I'm not sure if the tourism came first or if the homestay came first, but then you ended up working for the North Korean tourism sector. So, or a company in the North Korean tourism. So is that correct? And yeah, would you like to elaborate on that?
Yeah, pretty much correct. Although I don't know where you got homestay from. That's a fun one.
wasn't it a homestay?
No. So, but basically, like, it is pretty much correct. But in Japan, just to give you and also the listeners a bit of context, I was in Japan during the time of, we had like a refugee crisis in the UK, and also like lots of, we had a few terrorist attacks in Manchester and London, and I think, and that was why people were saying that the UK is dangerous. So it
is
was...
Is that the Ariande, Ariande,
Ariana Grande.
Grande? That's it. Was it the concert? Is that what you're referring to?
It Manchester? Wasn't, actually. Ariana Grande was a couple of years after. These terrorist attacks were, I think, during 2016. Yeah. So, you know, the UK was on high terror alert. So as seen from the outside perspective, when you read the travel advice, should I go there or not, it does look scary. But I had just come from the UK. The only thing that was kind of scary about it was one time I saw our police with guns. And like in the UK, that's terrifying when you see your own police with guns, because we don't use guns. Like the police don't have guns, like massive guns, right? So I remember that being the only thing that like put me off ease a little bit. But yeah, so that was the context behind why Japanese people were saying that the UK was too dangerous. And then I finished my degree, because I did an exchange in Japan, went back, finished my degree, and then started a job straight away in North Korea tourism for a different company, Young Pioneer Tours. And then about 6 months later, I changed companies to the company that I'm with today, Koryo Tours.
So when you first told your parents about this situation, about your desire to actually go to the Hermit Kingdom, I was told in, or actually you said in one of the podcasts that your mom was super upset. But I don't think you actually elaborated on how your dad reacted. So like, how did your dad react, and what do they think now that not only have you gone back, you know, a few times, but you're actually working in the North Korean sector? Like, what is their reaction to this news?
So, yeah, my mom was super upset. And it just got to the point where, like, we just, it became like an unspoken topic, because I am the kind of person, I mean, I'm an awful daughter, you know, I'm the kind of person that like, is like, even if you tell me that I can't do something, I'm still going to do it anyway. And my parents both know that. But you know, this time my mom was really like, you know, please don't go. But what happened was, is I asked her, like, I could understand her feeling. I could understand why she's worried. So I asked her like, okay, how about, you know, I'd done my research. I was like, how about you just Google this for 10 minutes, you know, just look into North Korea tourism. It's a thing, like, just look it up. And she refused to even write this name into Google. She was like, I don't even want to write those words down.
She didn't want Google to have like a search history? Is that what she was afraid of?
Yeah, I guess she was worried to like write those words down. And I was like, well, I can't listen to your opinion then. If you're not going to like do any research into it, I'm sorry, this time, like, I can't listen to you. And my dad, I probably didn't even run it past him, to be honest. I can't remember, but I wouldn't put it past me if, like, I'd have been in North Korea and then come out and been like, hey, dad, just got out of North Korea, what's up? but he's pretty cool, he's supportive. They're both supportive, but my dad, you know, finds it super cool what I do, and to the point that he was booked onto a tour. We were going to have like, he was going to come on a group tour and then we were going to do a bit of a private trip in April 2020. But then, of course, COVID happened. So we had to postpone that.
Mm-hmm. And how does your mom react now? Has she expressed any interest in going to North Korea?
Not at all. She's not a big traveler. And I think like because when I was living in Beijing, it was I would go in and out of North Korea on average about once a month. And she would never know when.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes some months it was like two or three times a month, like during summer, very busy. Other months I wouldn't go for like 1 or 2 months, right? So on average, I would say once a month. And she would never know when I'm there and when I'm not. So, you know, it's just like a topic that we don't talk about now.
Can I ask what drew you to North Korea so much? So you said you jump in and out sometimes once or twice a month when you're living in Beijing. There are a lot of countries which are pretty close as well. Like you could go to Mongolia, you can go to, I guess, Russia, you can go to South Korea. Like what about North Korea drew you? Because it seems like you have I'm not sure what the right word is, affiliation, like I guess just a, maybe that's the wrong word, but like you seem to enjoy it and you seem to like really enjoy this position of work in the North Korean tourism industry.
Yeah, I think there's a few aspects to it. So firstly, the North Koreans are great. You know, when I say North Koreans, I mean Korean. Like, I love the Korean culture. I love the Korean language. I love the Korean people. I was never drawn to North Korea. And I don't think I am in many aspects that other people would be. You know, many people go to North Korea because they're interested in either the politics or they're interested in the secrecy of it, or they are interested in, I don't know, you know, people seem to be very interested in the country, right, in many different aspects. But for me, I think the main reason that draws me to it and makes me want to keep going back is the fact that it's so normal and so, you know, there are people there are humans there. For me, it's all about showing people that North Korea is this, you know, it's not that what everyone else thinks. And I think that is what keeps drawing me back. The normality of it, the fact that, you know, I have friends in North Korea. You know, I would call them my friends, my colleagues. The food is great. And I think most people go in with such preconceptions, and to see those preconceptions and to see those, you know, prejudices against North Korea and stuff like that, that you have, to see those being completely shattered, even just within the first couple of minutes, it's just, for me, that's really special. And I really like, you know, I like to see that. And also I like to be able to show people and to help people kind of see what I see in North Korea, because my job is not, I'm not a tour guide in the sense of I'm like, okay, you know, this building was built in 19 blah blah blah. I'm not that kind of tour guide. It's more of a, I leave that to the North Koreans because they are professional, they've studied and they know, they're the local people, right? My job is more of a bridging gap between these two cultures, and I just love being that bridge where, you know, sometimes there's misunderstanding or lack of understanding from one side and the other side, and I like to help bridge that. And it's just a beautiful thing to see. So I think it's less of a a real love for North Korea and more of a passion for this area of work.
Okay, so does that mean, for example, if Mongolia was seen as public enemy number one, you would be passionate in exposing, like, I guess, a different side to Mongolia as well?
Potentially, if I found that it was there, yeah. I would be really interested in, you know, doing... I am really interested in going to really different places and different countries, and I continue to try and challenge my preconceptions on these countries. And I would love to do it in different places too, I suppose, yeah.
So can I touch back on something you said before? You said that you leave the X's and O's of, like, this building was built in, etc., to North Koreans, and you said that you're more of a bridge. What exactly does that mean? Does that mean, like, you're a translator for English or you're a translator for Korean? Or does that mean you just tag on to a tour and then once, I don't know, I guess a Westerner or foreigner has a question, you jump in and answer? Like, what does that mean, being a bridge between the two cultures?
It can have various meanings. So firstly, I'm not a translator because the guides can speak amazing English. And we also have tours that are, you know, if you have a group of people and you are all French or Spanish or Russian, then you can request that you have a Russian-speaking guide, a French-speaking guide. Within the North Korean company, there is about, I don't know how many languages they speak, but there is a lot of people that speak Chinese, a lot that speak English, Russian, you know, all of these many European languages, some really random languages as well, also Polish. So there's no language barrier there. It's more of a cultural barrier. And I think one of the main examples that I can give, which I recently put in a bit of an Instagram post in a story form, is how when you go to North Korea, you are always on a bus. And whether, you know, it's a big, like, tour bus, right? You've maybe got like 20 people on there. It's a big tour bus. And in the winter, it's heated. In the summer, it's cool, right? North Korea has very extreme summers and winters. It gets very hot, very cold. And yet, despite this, I mean, the springs and the autumns are quite nice. And despite the... I'm sure you're aware that when you go abroad and when you travel, you like to walk to places, right? Like, it's nice to be able to explore, use your own 2 feet, just, like, walk down some random streets, have a feel for the culture. And that's what everyone's like when they go to North Korea, right? They're like, oh, you know, do we have to go into the bus? Can't we walk to the next stop? And I'm like, well, yeah, we could, but, you know, we have to think about time constraints. We have to think about stuff like this. The North Koreans, they don't understand this at all, because in their eyes, they're providing this incredible bus that's, you know, luxury, and it's got heating or it's got air conditioning, and they're like, why would you want to walk when we have provided this for you? But so, you know, sometimes it can create a bit of conflict and stuff like that, or, like, yeah. And so I remember one of my good colleagues there, North Korean colleague, she went to Vietnam for the first time, and she went there on a work trip but also had, like, some leisure time. And, you know, I arrived in North Korea and she pulled me over and she was like, Zoe, I finally realized why people want to walk everywhere. You know, like, she got the same feeling. When she was in Vietnam, she realized, oh, okay, you can really get a feel for that place, get a feel for that culture when you, you know, have a walk around. And she finally understood that. And I think that's just one example of how two cultures can completely clash. You know, like, sometimes a foreigner can do something that's incredibly, you know, sensitive or incredibly seen as not a good thing to the North Koreans, but the, you know, a foreigner could just think nothing of it, and vice versa as well. And so I think it's just two vastly different cultures. Sometimes they can clash.
And I guess touching on a quote that you said somewhere or you wrote somewhere, which I thought was actually quite interesting, you said that, like, North Korea is a place that a lot of people have opinions about, but very few people have actually gone, which is part of the reason I wanted to get you on, because I get, I guess, a lot of exposure to South Korean culture and, I guess, East Asian culture in general, like the media and stuff like that. And because of that, implicit in that are certain depictions, certain expectations about North Korea. So can I ask, what are people's reactions when you say, hey, I'm Zoe and you're at a bar or something, and then I work for a North Korean tourism, like, do they ever accuse you of, like, lying? Like, what is the... I can't imagine saying that as an icebreaker.
Yeah, it's a good point. And so I never do say it as an icebreaker. Actually, I'm pretty private about the fact that I do that, especially with, like... Obviously, I'm not private in social media and in the realms of the internet. But if I'm meeting people, it's not actually a party trick that I use to get friends, you know? Like, usually I will say that I'm a tour guide or a tour guide in Korea, or I live in China and I'm a tour guide. If people want to keep knowing, and if there's no way that I can, like, avoid the question politely, then, of course, you know, I do say, actually... You know, it's a bit different because I do take people into North Korea. And I think their reactions are usually, like, quite confused. Like, oh. Like, you can see their brains working, like, well, okay. You know, it goes through so many levels. And I think most people are just quite interested. I do get most of the stuff that I get online... You know, I really think it helps when you get to know someone as a person, because online I get accused of, like, being a spy and, you know, being a communist and, like, just get accused of, like, being this awful, awful person. But no one has ever, ever said, maybe they're just too shy to, but no one's ever said anything nasty to my face. And I think part of that is, you know, it's easier to say bad things online, or easier to say your true feelings online. But generally, like, I think it helps a lot when you get to know me, because you do get to know that I am just a normal person, and my reasons for doing this, you know, not everyone might understand. But at the end of the day, it is, you know, it's important to, like you mentioned, it's important to get to know a country if you want to at least have an opinion on it. Mm. And so I think most people, you'd be surprised how uninterested they are in it, actually. You know, it doesn't become the topic of conversation for the evening. It's just like, oh, okay, you work in North Korea. Let's chat about that. Okay, next topic, you know.
Wow, so that's completely unexpected. I would have thought, like, that would be, like, the party trick to pull. Because it's just so attention-grabbing. But man, and to the audience, I will ask Zoe about, like, her experiences in North Korea. Like, you know, trust me, we're about to get to that. But can I ask, how did you get this position? Did you apply for it? Did they see that, oh, you've got English skills and you have some interest in the Korean culture? Did the company approach you? Like, how did you get offered this position?
So I first worked for the company that I went with originally when I went to North Korea, and that's YBT. And basically I went with them when I was living in Japan on the exchange, and I, like, genuinely, you know, they did a really good job tour guiding, and the tour guide was really good. And I remember looking to him and being like, I think I could do that. But at the time, you know, it was just in the back of my head. And I think I do possess a lot of qualities that make me a good tour guide in general. You know, I think, you know, I'm friendly, I'm outgoing, but I'm also responsible and stuff like that. So I remember, you know, thinking, hey, that's, you know, maybe something that I could do after graduation, but didn't think much of it. And then in around April time, just before I was about to graduate, I remember seeing an advert on Facebook for a job. With the company. And so basically I applied for it. They remembered me as a tourist, and got it from there. Had a couple of interviews and that was it.
Wow. Okay. So let's, I guess I've got so many questions about North Korea, and I just want to, you know, throw a few at you. Some of the stuff that I've heard is, like, maybe they're preconceptions, maybe they're true. But as someone who's actually entered the country, I'm very, very curious to see, you know, whether these, I'm not sure what you call them, expectations are true or if they're false. And something I remember my South Korean friend saying, who lives in Sydney, she said that I think her family actually came from North Korea and then they migrated to the South during the Civil War. But basically she said something to the extent of, like, if I go to North Korea because I am proficient in English, or she's proficient in English, I should say, she said there's a chance that I may be kidnapped because I am, I guess, Korean and I am proficient in English. And then she said there is a chance, she never specified if it's 100% or 1%, but that I would be enlisted to teach English. So that was, I guess, one of the few times I ever hear about North Korea.
What do you think about that? Do you think that's exaggerated, or do you think there is something like that in the country?
I think that's very exaggerated. So what, like, if you went on a tour to North Korea, you might get kidnapped, is basically what?
Yes. Okay. Yes. But the thing is...
Because of your Korean heritage.
If maybe I went, or if you went, or someone else went, I'm not really sure. I guess I'm just assuming, because she's not next to me and she can't really answer. But because this expectation or this understanding that Korea is united, it's just politically separated, she is, like, I guess, a citizen. I'm not sure if I'm giving her words justice, but yeah, what is your reaction to that?
It's funny. I've never heard, I mean, it's, you know, these things are quite exaggerated, and they do make me laugh, and I shouldn't laugh, but it's, you know, sorry to break it to you, but you're not that important to the North Korean regime that they're going to kidnap you. So, you know, your English skills are great. But you're really not that important to the North Korean regime that they would kidnap you. There's so much at stake. Imagine if they did that. Like, it's just not, it would be like massive news. You know, you're an Australian citizen, right?
Yeah, and my friend is as well.
Okay, so you're Australian citizens. So, like, you know, imagine the beef between North Korea and Australia, like, and all, just over, I'm sorry to, like, put you down here, but, like, just over some random guy that maybe is going to teach English there. They have, to be fair, they have a history of kidnapping, right? And I think one of the most famous ones is have you heard of the film Bulgasari?
No.
Okay, that's fine. It's a North Korean film, and it's like the Godzilla of North Korea. It's such an out of this world film. Would really recommend you give it a go. But it's quite the film. It's very interesting. The director for that, I don't want to go over the story here also because I might like get some things wrong. But basically, there's been a history of South Korean directors being kidnapped and taken to North Korea, and they helped to direct that film. That's a whole big different story. So, you know, that has happened in the past, but that was like, they were like the most famous movie director in South Korea, and that was like years ago as well. And I don't want to say, you know, times have changed, but like they definitely have. And I just can't imagine North Korea kidnapping someone now and being like, oh yeah, no, we just need them for a bit to like make a film or something. I just can't imagine it happening now. And so, yeah, I think, and also, you know, I have taken a lot of South Koreans to North Korea before. And when I say South Koreans, I mean people of South Korean heritage, or even South Koreans who, you know, have been... who have a different passport now. So they grew up in South Korea, they've spent their whole lives in South Korea, but maybe they moved to a European country and gave up their South Korean passport. And so they're traveling on a European passport. And that's absolutely fine. Speaking English is absolutely no difference, you know, like whether you speak English or not. Speaking Korean, however, that does make the guides a little bit more nervous. You know, it's no problem if you speak Korean. Obviously, like I speak a little bit of Korean, it's absolutely no problem. But like they might just be a little bit more wary. Especially at first, you know, they're a very paranoid country and they're very paranoid about spies and stuff like that. But, you know, give them no reason to think you're a spy and they will not think that you're a spy at the end of the day. So it's absolutely fine.
Wait, can I elaborate on that? When you say that if you speak Korean, there is a bit of, I guess, hesitancy or apprehension. Mm-hmm. Is it because they think that they're a spy, or is it just because they feel like they might say something in front of them? Like, why? Yeah, I'm just trying to understand why would being fluent in Korean make the guides more scared?
I think it's a little bit of both. And I think it's not so much with the tourists, you know, like if you're a tourist and you just go in and out once, you know, that it's been said to me that like, you know, it's best that I don't show off my Korean so much. And I think that is basically that, you know, they're probably more concerned with someone going in and out of the country a lot like me, then, you know, picking up the language a lot, then they may be concerned, you know, maybe I'm a spy and stuff. It's not so good that I show that off. But with tourists, I think it's mainly just the, oh, you know, okay, we have to not say something dumb around them. And whether that be like top secret North Korean regime secrets, or whether that be like, oh, this tourist is annoying, saying that in Korean, you know, it's anything. I just mean anything. They have to be careful around you. But, you know, at the end of the day, actually, it's really, really beautiful seeing Koreans going over to North Korea, and the guides end up being best friends with them. They always sit at the back of the bus, just chatting away in Korean, just having a good time. And so you do see that joining of those two cultures. It's really nice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what is the reaction of South Koreans when they go over? So I want to tell a story. There's a really famous mountain in North Korea, Changpek or something like that. I'm apologize to any Koreans. There you go. I don't know where I got the Chang from, but anyway, that mountain, it's very famous because like a lot of the, I guess, spirituality comes from that. And it was believed that gods or something like came out of that. And I from what I've heard, Kim Jong-un or whatever has said that he was born around that in order to, I guess, take the mythos. But basically, there's a ritual that I've heard that some South Koreans take water from South Korea. They go to China, which is basically, I guess it's physically joined to North Korea, and they will pour some South Korean water into the North Korean mountain lake, that area, in order to symbolize reunification. So hearing that, like, there's obviously an emotional wound. And for anyone who's been to the DMZ, you'll know there's like an emotional wound from being split. How do South Koreans react? You said obviously they become good friends, but is there anything more in particular? Do they ever get like emotional at seeing like, I guess, the other side?
Yeah, I think they do. I'd never heard that story, so that's really interesting. And actually, Paektusan is half in China, half in South Korea. Like you can, half in North Korea. You can visit it from both sides. Seeing South Koreans in North Korea is really nice, and I think they do get emotional, especially if they've had some kind of like family ties to it, maybe, you know, deep in the past, like their grandfather or something like that was in North Korea, or maybe, you know, their grandfather or parents before that spent like time living in areas in the North Korea, because we have to remember that like it's not been separated for that long, and there are people still alive today that remember a unified Korea, and they just happen to be on the different side of the border on the day when the line was drawn. People do get emotional. And I have to say, like, I haven't taken in like loads of South Koreans. I've taken in, you know, a few, because for South Koreans, they can't travel on their passports. So there aren't that many Koreans that can go. It's only Koreans with different passports that can go. So, you know, whilst I have taken in a couple, it's not been that many, but it's certainly, you definitely feel that it's, there's something else there than just the normal tourist.
Mm-hmm. And there was this program in South Korea. I've forgotten the name of it, but something about memories or lost, something like that. But the premise of the program was, during a warm period of relationship between the North and the South, they would reconnect South and North members for a brief period of time. I'm not sure if you've heard of this. Was that allowed to air in North Korea? This is before your time, because this was decades ago. But do you know if that was that symbol of reunification was allowed to be aired in North Korea?
That's a good question. I don't know, but I don't see why it wouldn't have been. It was permitted, and they do still have like some kind of, where they meet up family members from North and South. Like it wasn't just like for a show or something like that. Like they do, it still does go on actually. But relations were a lot better, like, you know, during the Sunshine period and stuff like that. I think one thing that shocks most people when they hear about North Korea is when I tell them that like the thing that they want the most is reunification. You know, for some reason, a lot of people think like that it's the South that wants to be reunified, and it's the friendly one, and then the North is this really hostile one that doesn't want reunification. And actually, like, it's not that it's the opposite way around, but like in South Korea, it's getting less and less pro reunification, basically as the society gets older, the people who remember a unified Korea are dying away, and then the younger generation just see North Korea as this nuisance. You know, it economically it would be bad, they'd have to prop up the country, and also they see North Korea as a threat, and they don't see the North Koreans as their own people anymore. But North Korea, you know, their biggest desire is to reunify. And obviously, you know, it's on different terms than the you know, international stage might want. So that's where the difficulty comes in. But generally, like, if you ask any North Korean, that's what they want. They want to reunify. And I think that's really important to remember. So it's you'll see lots of aspects of reunification within the country. On the road that goes all the way down from Pyongyang to the DMZ, to the JSA that we were talking about at the start of this episode, they have, like, I don't know if you've ever seen this image of the statue. They have two women wearing the joguri, like the Korean dresses, and they're joining hands together at the top, holding the reunified, like, the Korean peninsula. And that's the Arch of Reunification. So that was built there, I think, during the Sunshine period, to basically celebrate reunification when it was looking very likely. And so, yeah, there's nothing wrong with showing reunification stuff. But to answer your question, I have no idea whether it was shown in North Korea, but I don't see why it might not have been.
And when was the Sunshine period? When did that occur?
That's a very good question, and I wish I knew my history better. I think it was in the 1980s. I think it was in the 1980s. Yeah, mm-hmm. But you might not. If that's wrong, please don't quote me on it.
talking about the emotional wound from separation, this is something I saw when I was in Taiwan. Now, Taiwan's stance has changed, I guess, in the recent decades, especially since Tsai Ing-wen came to office. But if you look at, and I guess you can talk about this because you were actually in Taiwan, but if you look at a lot of, like, the roads or a lot of the names of, like, organizations or companies or just, like, places, a lot of them say, like, Zhonghua Minzhu, which basically translates to, like the Chinese Republic or the Chinese, the people, or, like, you know, the government or the Republic of China, really. And now, granted, you know, with the KMT, now I'm going to Chinese history, but with the political party, the KMT, I guess, losing a lot of power, maybe that desire of reunification has actually separated. But I was, like, really surprised when I went to Taiwan that there were so many allusions towards, like, a unified China. Because basically what I've heard from the media, it was always, like, the mainland was the one who really wanted to reunify. And maybe that is the case now. But it was just kind of shocked me just walking around, like, these different places in Taiwan, and then you would see, like, allusions towards, like, you know, the Chinese Republic or, you know, the KMT and blah blah blah, and, like, a unified China. But once again, you know, just, I guess, just to check the boxes, that might be different nowadays.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation, and I don't know if it's so, because you're right, like, in the past there was a lot of, it's not about reunification actually, it's more about not power or control, but, you know, for China and Taiwan, both governments see themselves as the legitimate ruler of China, right? And so you have the ROC, which is Taiwan, Republic of China, and then you have the PRC, which is People's Republic of China, and that is mainland China. And it's less about the reunification, but more of the fact that neither of them see each other. I mean, it's the same in North and South Korea as well. Neither see them as the legitimate ruler of China or of Korea. And I think for Taiwan and for China in the past, it was definitely more about the control over that area and ruling, right? But then you're right. Years later, definitely the feel in Taiwan is not about, you know, okay, Taiwan is the legitimate ruler of the whole of China. It's definitely less about that, and more about, okay, you know, we're Taiwan, we just want to do our own thing. Whereas mainland China, they're probably more provocative, wanting to, you know, yeah, reunify, I suppose, can be the term that we use. I don't know with the street signs and stuff, whether it's, you know, using the terminology like Zhonghua Minzu or stuff like that, whether it's about, you know, a political statement or more left over from earlier periods, or also just the fact the terminology used for example, in ROC and PRC versus PRC. And I think, yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting...
Well, I think it's definitely a leftover, but
yeah.
From the KMT, you know, the Chiang Kai-shek period of time. Now, once again, we're getting into Chinese history, but like, yeah, I guess it just surprised me because, just talking about like the media, a lot of times I hear like, you know, it's the mainland. And I would say that is true. If the mainland is the one that wants to reunify. Mm. So I was, I guess, shocked that when I went to Taiwan with my preconceptions that I would still see remnants of this like leftover history of like, you know, Chiang Kai-shek basically saying, no, we are taking back the mainland, you know, give me 10 years, give me 5 years, I will take back the mainland and, you know, be the rightful government. But yeah, let's get back to North and South. There is another thing that often comes to people's minds when they think of North Korea. So there is, I guess, the politics. And apart from that, something else is the poverty. That's often an image of North Korea that's often pushed up a lot. And for North Korea, I got these statistics online, so I can't really verify, but apparently the entire country, their GDP is around 28.5 billion, whilst, you know, if we compare it to South Korea, apparently it's like 1.8 trillion, and this is both in US dollars. So can I talk and ask you about the poverty in North Korea? Is it quite apparent? Like, is it apparent in the capital city, Pyongyang, or is it only apparent outside? Like, what are some examples, are there examples of poverty in that area?
So I think, yeah, you can see poverty all throughout North Korea, but also it's not all throughout the country. When I say that you can see it everywhere, that doesn't mean that it is everywhere, right? I've been to countries that are way poorer than North Korea. So when we have this image of North Korea, and, you know, poverty stricken, undernourished, stuff like that, it does exist, but it's not everything about North Korea. And also, I've been to a lot of places that I've been a lot more upset in. You know, you have seen a lot, I've seen a lot worse, but you can't compare.
Can you give an example of a country?
I mean,
or is like, that too spicy?
I mean, yeah, I've traveled, you know, when you go around Southeast Asia, okay, I don't want to give like a country or something like that, but like if you go to a lot of places in Southeast Asia, you know, it's not as if you see, it's poorer, right? There are countries that are poorer than North Korea, I think is what I'm trying to say here. You know, where they put their money in is completely up to them. But you see a lot of infrastructure and stuff like that in North Korea, like in Pyongyang. And that, you know, that's the same for any capital city that you see around the world, also in Southeast Asia. And Southeast Asia is a massive place. Obviously, you've got like really rich countries there and stuff. I'm always worried about who I'm going to offend now. So I'm not saying that Southeast Asia as a whole is very, very poor. Mm-hmm. But there are, so Pyongyang is the capital, right? In many other countries, that's where all the money goes as well. You've got great infrastructure in some respects, awful in others. The transport system is incredibly cheap, probably the cheapest in the world. And, you know, it's great. The roads can be a bit rocky. Buildings are a bit crusty by now. You know, a lot of them were built some years ago and are now falling down a little bit. But in general, it's a pretty good city, you know, and they're building stuff all the time. They managed to build this one entire road in 1 year. I think it's Midae Street, Future Scientist Street.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And they built that whole road in 1 year. I think it was completed in 2019 or 2018. And when I say the road, I don't just mean like the tarmac on the road. I mean like the block of flats, the houses, everything, like all done in 1 year. And of course they have that big massive hotel and stuff. It was going to be the world's highest hotel back when it was supposed to be completed in the 1980s or 1990s. Obviously Dubai has like kind of outrun that now a little bit. And many other countries in the world actually have outrun how tall it was supposed to be. I can't remember off the top of my head how tall it was going to be. But you know, North Korea can't compete with that anymore. So there's a lot of construction going on, and there is a lot of good infrastructure. When you go out of Pyongyang, then you will see, like, it's more countryside, you know, the roads are rickety. The guides call it a free massage when you're on your way down from Pyongyang to the DMZ, because you do just sit there and it's a very, very bumpy ride. And you might see people, like, for example, plowing and pulling oxes to do the farming, or on the roadside waiting for a lift. Maybe they look cold, or, you know, stuff like this. It's so hard to describe poverty, and it's something that I think if you ask me this question about any country, I would also feel uncomfortable trying to describe it anyway. And obviously in North Korea, it's a sensitive one. So, you know, I find it tricky, but I've seen people like in schools, maybe a girl without shoes on. You know, I've seen they have teeth falling out. It's just these aspects of poverty that you do see in other countries as well. One interesting aspect of poverty that you don't see that I do want to mention here is like, and it shocks me every single time when I go back to the UK. And genuinely, from living in China and living in and working in North Korea, two kind of, you know, socialist countries, I really get shocked every time I go back to the UK and I see homeless people everywhere. Like, especially up in the north where I'm from, walking around the main city, you just see homeless people everywhere. And that really gets to me because, you know, you don't see that in a lot of China and in North Korea. Whether they're moved on or not, you know, is another thing. But on the whole, generally, everyone in North Korea has a house that's provided for them. And whether the idea of the socialist system is that the government provides everything for you, right? And obviously, for a time in North Korea, this really worked. For a time, North Korea's GDP was higher than South Korea's right at the start. So for a time, this did work. Obviously, now it's not working because what the government provides is not enough. And this is where the issues, you know, come, and this is where poverty comes from. But they do provide things like free education and free housing and stuff like that. And I think, like, when I talk about North Korea, it's so important that you know, not everything is black and white. There are good things, and when I say those words that are to do with North Korea, people then suddenly come at me. And I think that's the lack of understanding that we have from just listening to the media and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And talking about poverty, something that really surprised me when I was in Taiwan, and once again, I guess you're in Taiwan, so maybe you can have a look and confirm or, you know, unconfirm, but I was really shocked because Taiwan generally has a high GDP per capita compared to the mainland. How many homeless people there were around, what's it called, Taipei, the main general, the main train station in particular. I was like, I was actually baffled by the amount of poverty. And, you know, no system is perfect, so this just might be like a negative, a bug in the, you know, a capitalist system. But I can't confirm what the poverty rate is in, what it's like in mainland. I would have just thought Taiwan there would be less just because the GDP per capita is higher. But yeah, that was something that shocked me as well. But
Yeah,
and you know what, like talking about, you know, South Korea, and maybe it's really easy to compare North and South because, you know, like there is a political split, and at the same time, they're both ethnically Korean. There are also displays of like poverty in South Korea, which like shocked me as well. Like you see a lot of old people working in South Korea, but at the same time, I'm sure there are displays of as you said, like, you know, the girl without the shoes, or, you know, with teeth falling out or stuff like that. There are displays of poverty in both.
And I think, like, looking at South Korea as well, it's important talking in terms of black and white. It's not as if, like, South Korea is the good Korea and North Korea is the bad Korea, because, and, like, that is the be-all and end-all. Like, it's not black and white like that, you know? Like, in South Korea has its own issues, and those issues are issues that come from the government that it's you know, that rules it, in a lot of respects. You know, for example, high suicide rates and overworking and stuff like that. I think those things, you know, we can't look to South Korea and be like, okay, this is the perfect, this is what we need, you know, this is what North Korea needs to turn into. And it's so hard to criticize a country when you haven't got it right yourself. And that's how I found, you know, being active and going in and out of North Korea, like, who am I coming from a British society that, you know, really doesn't have things right, especially now. I mean, British politics is crazy at the moment. I don't know how much you know about it, but, you know, coming from that kind of government and where we have so many homeless, where we have so many people now that need to choose between having three meals a day or cutting one out and having the heating on instead during winter. You know, normal people, this is not people who previously experienced poverty, but that's the point where we are up to at the moment in the UK. And I think, like, how can we then go into North Korea and be like, hey, by the way, you've got everything wrong, because this is how we do it, and it's better how we do it. You know, we have no right to do that.
Mm. Just a quick tidbit about the UK. I'm not sure if this is true. And, like, if it is true, I just think it'll be just so politically chaotic. But apparently there was talk that Boris Johnson wants to, like, challenge the leadership again. I'm not sure if that's true, and he wants to take on Rishi Sunak. Part of me is like, man, if that happens, it would just be chaos. Like, the Conservative government is just chaos.
Well, he ran to be Prime Minister again. Like, I can't keep tracks of who is doing what at the moment, but just before Rishi Sunak, like, came into presidency, Prime Ministership, whatever we call it in the UK, came into office, like, Boris Johnson was in the running, but, like, he didn't get enough votes to, like, get through, you know, the stages, like, mm-hmm. there's several mm-hmm. stages. So, yeah, maybe he wants to be back. Let's see.
I have another question about North Korea, and I think I would be remiss to touch upon this. So I know that in your YouTube, you talk about, like, this is a politically free zone, or as much as possible. So, you know, it's up to you whether you're able to answer this, whether you want to answer this. Something that you hear is that, like, because of the political system in North Korea, there is censorship. Now, granted, you know, let's not be black and white. There is censorship everywhere in the world. But I guess it's particularly prevalent in North Korea. Do you ever feel like what is described as a chilling effect? And what that means is, like, in North Korea, you just know there are certain things that you can or can't say. And there is almost like a chilling effect. That's how it's described in, like, the newspapers and stuff, on freedom of expression or something like that. So are you, I guess, more sensitive? Like, do you have heightened awareness in North Korea because you have this feeling that there are obvious yes and there's obvious no? So do you get that feeling?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's important to have that when you're in North Korea, to be honest, because there are certain things that you can talk about and there are certain things that you can't talk about. And I think from a tourism perspective, from a tourist, you know, you need to be able to know what is going too far. And, you know, I don't mean to say this to, like, scare people and stuff. Generally, it's absolutely fine to talk about anything, but there are, like, certain topics, and it's basically just politics and the personal lives of the leaders and religion. They're basically the three main topics that we say kind of not to get involved about a little bit, like, too much. Obviously, you can ask about politics and the political system, but if you're going to challenge it, that's where the problem lies. And I think I definitely censor my own speech when I'm in North Korea. I also get the feeling that a lot of the time I'm not getting the full story. And also my social media, I self-censor that as well, because I want to be able to get back into North Korea. And so a lot of people ask me on social media, hey, why don't you show us the prison camps, and why don't you show us the poverty and stuff like that? And I'm like, well, on the one hand, like, you say that me visiting North Korea is not ethical. And I'm like, well, is it ethical to go there and film these prison camps and stuff like that? And then on the other hand, also, I'm very blunt about this. I'm like, also, I can't visit them. And even if I could, I wouldn't want to take pictures for the ethical reasons. And also for the fact that I want to go back to North Korea. And, you know, if I start doing that kind of stuff, then I'm not going to be able to. Also, that's not the reason why I do all this stuff in the first place. You know, I'm not there to show all of that. If people want to see that stuff, they can go elsewhere. Mm. But yeah, I don't know if that answers your question on censorship. But
can I talk about the DMZ, just switching topics? And once again, for the audience, just to refresh your memory, the demilitarized zone. That is just a region between North and South where basically the military, I guess, is like kind of pulled back because they're currently in a truce. Have you been to the DMZ from the South Korean side?
Funnily enough, not, no. But I've heard of it, it's a lot stricter. I've been to some areas along the DMZ because it's not, I mean, it's a massive line all across the country, right? But I've never been to the JSA Panmunjom area that everyone knows, the blue huts and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, can you talk about like how it's depicted in North Korea? So when you go to DMZ, and I'm sure as someone who went to the South Korean DMZ, it's depicted, I guess, in a more favorable South Korean light. And I'm sure the North Koreans do the exact same thing. So in the South, there is a big emphasis on like the 3 or 4 tunnels. Apparently that was dug in order for the North Koreans, if the opportunity arises, to come, soldiers I'm talking about, to come into South Korea. Like when you go to North Korea, the DMZ on the North Korean side, I'm assuming they don't emphasize that, and they would emphasize like a South Korean atrocity or something like that, or something that paints themselves in a more positive light. Do you, I guess, what do they talk about in the North Korean DMZ?
That's a very good question. I think they show a lot of history in the North Korean DMZ area, and the whole trip lasts for about 2 or 3 hours. And they do talk about the atrocities from the war, you know, and it's very, it's probably more directed towards like anti-imperialist sentiments, you know, like the Korean Peninsula was divided by foreign powers that, you know, in reality had no place in, you know, meddling in the business of the Korean Peninsula kind of thing. I suppose that's quite the narrative there. And when you go through, you go first to an area where, you know, they signed the armistice agreement, and you can have a look around all of these like kind of museum-y kind of places. And then you go to the Blue Hut areas. And I think, a lot of the narrative is mainly about how they want reunification, but it's mainly the foreign powers preventing this from happening.
Mm-hmm. Do they ever talk about, like, I guess, South Korean in a negative light? Do they ever say, like, oh, South Korean are puppets or something like that? Like, I guess what I'm trying to say is in South Korea, there is an obvious point, like, to say, oh, look, the North Koreans tried to invade. Isn't that bad? Is there that equivalent in North Korea? Do they point at any tunnels that, I don't know, South Korean built or something like that?
That's a very good question, actually. I'm sure that they do. And I'm always so like busy doing other things than actually listening to what they're saying. Like usually I'm less of a tourist when I'm there. So I am like busy with answering other people's questions. Like if they have something, or like talking to the guides and stuff, like if they have any issues. I sound really awful, but I'm like, I can't really like pinpoint exactly where they say and what they're taking to you now. Also my memory's really bad, but I would say any of their like narratives on South Korea, a lot of it depends on the relations at the time as well. So maybe at the DMZ area, I think it's less about anti-South Korea stuff, I have to say. Whereas in other places, they may have like maybe museums and stuff like that. But generally, there is less anti-South Korea sentiment and more anti-American, anti-Japanese.
Mm-hmm. Anti-imperialist, as they would say.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Switching to a slightly different topic. this is a core memory I have from my year 10 economics teacher, who was a blonde teacher. And she said that, she told me something which, like, I was just amazed by it. But she said that one time she was traveling around Cairo, and that because I guess blondes are not very common in Cairo, she talked about a proposal that she got on the street. Just a random man came up to her and said, like, I love you. Do you want to be my wife? Has that ever happened, or anything strange happened in North Korea because you do stand out? So first question, anything strange and any marriage proposals? So, and second question, anytime, and if you're able to speak about this, anytime that you felt it was more dangerous. So like you were passing through an army garrison or something like that. So yeah, strange experiences and anytime you felt dangerous or uncomfortable.
Really good questions. I like these questions. No one ever asks me them before. On the marriage proposals, so I used to live in Zimbabwe, actually. I spent like 3 months living there, and on the streets of Zimbabwe...
Wow, Zoe, you just pick the... You just pick, like, places that, like, the Westerners usually never go to. And you're like, oh, wait, Zimbabwe. All right, Tanzania. All right.
Yeah, that's what I try and do. So and that's, on the streets of Zimbabwe, I did pick up quite a few marriage proposals, I have to say, especially walking around by myself. It was genuinely quite difficult to walk down the street without being stopped if I was by myself. Like, it was, you know, I generally didn't do it. In North Korea, however, no. And it's an interesting point because definitely no marriage proposals. And that's an interesting point in itself because the North Koreans, I get this question a weird amount of times, like, you know, any romances between the North Koreans and stuff like that. And I think it's really important to note that, so the North Koreans, they're very proud people, and they're proud of their strong bloodline of Korean bloodline, right? And I think in that respect, any relations with foreigners and stuff is one on in terms of ethnically, you know, like really frowned upon, and also in terms of like the Korean government, the North Korean government, it just wouldn't be permitted. There have been in the past, like, there's, I don't know if you've ever heard of the story of Joe Dresnok. He is a American who defected into North Korea.
Oh, I have, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So there's actually three of them. And anyway, he passed away kind of in recent years. And he has, like, had a North Korean wife, and then he has North Korean kids. So, you know, this does happen. And also Kenji Fujimoto, I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He was, like, the private chef to the Kim family, to Kim Jong-un, Kim Jong-il. He has a restaurant in Pyongyang, which I've been to, and I have a video on my YouTube. He's also married, or has at least, yeah, he has children with a North Korean woman. So that does happen, but I have yet to receive my marriage proposal. Let's see. being blonde does attract a little bit of attention, but I would say that actually not so much in North Korea, because a lot of the foreign tourists that come in, you know, maybe blonde or whatever. So I think when the main shock is them seeing tourists in general, not necessarily like, oh, you know, okay, this blonde girl and stuff. Walking around Bangladesh, that was very interesting, being blonde and trying to blend in. And literally just every time I stopped to check my maps on my phone, like, I would just have a crowd around me. Absolutely fine. They're absolutely lovely.
Crowd.
Yeah, literally. Okay. Like Bangladesh was my favorite, is in my top five favorite countries to travel around. Absolutely amazing. Love Bangladesh. Never, ever didn't feel safe, despite the fact that I would constantly have a crowd of people around me wanting to take selfies. But amazing country. But and going on to the safe thing, there's been honestly no time that I've felt unsafe in North Korea. And that's because you are on a guided tour. So there's never been a time where I've been like, oh, okay, like, try and blend in here. Because there is no blending in. You know, even South Koreans would find it hard to blend into North Korea in general, you know, just because of their demeanor and what they're wearing. And I think, you know, you are on a guided tour, you're taken around. So there's been no place where I felt nervous, where I felt like I need to blend in. There've been a couple of times where I wish that I blended in more. Like, for example, those times when you do have a bit more freedom, when you visit a mass dance, you know, and these are like the really big ones. Like there was a mass dance I went to once in Kim Il Sung Square, and there's like, you know, thousands of people dancing in the center, and it would have been just really nice. And you know, we say to people, okay, go have fun for half an hour, just don't wander off too much. Everyone kind of knows the rules, stick around, but also enjoy yourself. And in those time periods, I wish that I blended in a little bit more and didn't attract too much attention, or during New Year's and stuff, when you're in a big crowd of Koreans, it's just kind of you in there. But I feel like that in a lot of countries. So especially in Taiwan, you know, like people look at me and it's hard to, sometimes it's hard to blend in, but never felt
unsafe. Do you ever scare them in Taiwan or Korea when you actually start speaking the language?
Yeah, I think so.
Because that's like a power move.
You do catch people like talking about you, and then you start speaking. And like my Korean is not great. Like it's fine. I can get by, it's kind of with struggles. But like my Chinese, I have to say, is like quite good. And it's also, it's a kind of nice Taiwan accent I've managed to get now. So, and I also have tried to learn Taiwanese, the local language mm-hmm. here. Wow. So I do kind of scare them a little bit, I suppose. But yeah.
Can I ask, have you watched the popular K-drama? It's called Crash Landing on You.
Of course.
So I was recommended this by a previous friend, and she really suggested I watch it. I guess to the audience, I admit guilt. I didn't finish it because I just found it was too cliche, like this like incredibly handsome North Korean general or something, soldier, meets this like incredibly good looking South Korean woman, and then he like defects immediately. He's like, no, that's it. I love her. And to me, I'm just like, oh, this is just a little too cliche. You know, the power of love overwhelms everything, blah, 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 blah. I will admit, I did not finish it. I got up to episode 6, I believe, and then I stopped. But yeah, like, to what extent do you think that is like true or false? Because these are the popular preconceptions of North Korea. And whether or not, and I often say this, like, you know, whether or not that idea is true or it's not, the fact that it's commonly held means it has power. So when you compare it to things like Crash Landing on You, like, do you think that's super exaggerated? Do you think, like, you know, like the depiction of, like, you know, the, I don't know, the government or the society or something like that? Like, have you seen those? I'm not sure if you remember, but like the guy lives in like a small village or something like that. Are the villages, do they look like that? Do the food look like that? Do people dress like that? Do people talk like that? How accurate is Crash Landing on You?
So it's a really good question, and I think if you found it like too cliche, you probably just don't like South Korean dramas in general, I think, right?
Yeah,
like...
I don't really. I love the film. Films are great. Indie, I love indie South Korean music. Like, I love that stuff. I love the film, but I just can't get down with the dramas.
Yeah, no, like, so I would say it's one of the more accessible ones for those that aren't used to South Korean dramas. It's actually not so crazy and dramatic. So yeah, if your listeners do want to give it a go, it's very good. And because it is actually really accurate, I think that they did like chat to some defectors and stuff like that in order to, you know, provide an accurate insight into North Korean life. So I have to say they did do a really good job of that. And obviously there's some things that were a little bit off, or some things that, you know, that are like, that wouldn't happen. But in general, they did a really good, you know, a really good depiction of it. I think the houses where they lived, the little villages, very true. One of the things that I could really relate to was the clan barbecue that they did. So they got, and they do it exactly like they do in North Korea as well. Like, yeah, it's amazing. So when we go to one of the guests, like the hotels alongside the West Coast in a place called Nampo, we often do this thing called clam barbecue. And basically you get like, there's a stone, and they have these stones like on the floor at the hotel area. It's like a guest house area, and they do this in Crash Landing on You as well. They have this stone on the floor, and then you line up the clams all around in like a circle and a spiral going in, And then actually we douse this then with like petrol and just set it on fire. and it turns into this petrol clam barbecue. And the petrol, it all burns off, and you put the clams like upside down. So when they open facing down. So like mm-hmm. none of the petrol has like gone inside them, right? And so anyway, they should be nice and cooked. And you know, you have them with some soju, and they do that in Crash Landing on You. I don't know if you managed to make it that far into that scene. I think it was quite early on. But yeah, so it's just little things like that that really did remind me of North Korea.
Mm. And, you know, talking about the power of media, like, we rarely ever see anything from North Korea. Actually, there is one North Korean song I've heard on YouTube. I forgot the name of it, but yeah, that's like literally the only sort of media input I have received from the North. Like, how much of the outside world do North Koreans see? Is there quite a strong, I guess if you use Cold War language, like Iron Curtain around the country? Or yeah, like what extent do they know about China, or do they know about like Europe or England or something like that?
So it depends which North Korean you're speaking to. The ones who have a better education, who've been to university, will know a lot. Like, and in general, like, they're super smart. It's so funny, like, watching people try and tourists will try and like tell the North Koreans about their country and act like they're so naive and they're so dumb and that they know nothing, and then the North Koreans will come back with something like, oh yes, did that happen during this period? And they're so smart, especially if they've been to university, they have an amazing education system, and they do know a lot of history, geography, stuff like that. What they don't know a lot on is, I would say, like modern culture, technology, stuff like that. And again, it depends which North Koreans that you're talking about, because the guides who have a lot of foreign interaction, you know, they know about Facebook, they know about Instagram. Everyone always comes into the country and is like, oh, like, have you seen this? You know, like, look, this is like this social media that we have.
I can like this person's photo.
Yeah. And the North Koreans are like, yeah, like, we know you have that. Uh-huh. Like, but I'm sure if you showed someone else, like, from the countryside, mm-hmm. they'd probably be really confused. It's not as if mm-hmm. they would be suddenly enlightened, like, oh my God, thank you so much for showing me. Like, you know, I think some people really think that they're, like,
thank you, enlightening. Zuckerberg.
Yeah, I think these people, like, a lot of tourists go in and they're like, okay, I'm going to show them everything that I can. And I'm like, I don't think that they're, like, craving all of this, like, information a lot of the time. And, like, sometimes they just mm-hmm. don't care. But they do have, you know, they don't get a lot of outside input, especially in terms of like, pop culture and stuff like that. You know, any news that they get is probably like the important news in terms of football and stuff like that. That, you know, matches are put on, live matches are put on like a few days later. Mm-hmm. So I think in a lot of aspects, they are much more closed off than people might think, and in a lot of aspects they are a lot less closed off than you might think. You know, in general, mm-hmm. like films and music and stuff is not permitted, but that doesn't mean that like all foreign films and all music is not permitted. At university they watch the film Titanic, and you know, a lot of them, when you go to visit the Grand People Study House, they will probably put on the Beatles in the music room, and you can listen to the Beatles standing in Pyongyang, and it's quite strange, especially
they
for me.
Watch Titanic?
Yeah.
In North...
Yeah.
That's such a capitalist film. Like, it's such like a Hollywood blockbuster. Like that's the thing I wouldn't expect would be allowed.
Yeah, and I think it's I think that's part of the English lessons and stuff in the university. So, you know, they have Harry Potter in the library. Actually, they have really interestingly, they started doing audiobooks and stuff like that. And they can download these audiobooks on their phone. I remember one of the guides telling me, I might do a little story time on this on Instagram because it was really cute. One of the guides, like, we were talking about Harry Potter as we were walking through the library. And he was like, oh yeah, you know, would you recommend it? And I'm like, yeah, it's good. It's a great series. Like, everyone loves it in the UK, at least. So he went off for a few minutes and he came back and he's like, oh, I got the audiobook on my phone. And I'm like, oh, amazing. Mm. And he was like, yeah, it's Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. And I was like, you got the third one? Like, did you read the first one or the second one first? Yeah, and he was there's multiple? And I was like, yeah. So I was like, that's so innocent and that's so cute.
So to wrap up this podcast, I've got a true or false section. So I went online and I found some information, and some of this could be true, some of this could be false. I'm asking, I guess at this point, purely out of my own curiosity, because I'm just mm-hmm. so curious about like these different cultures, places I've never been to. So I'll say, you know, I'll ask you the question and then you mm-hmm. can say true or false. And if you want to elaborate on it, feel free. And if you don't want to elaborate on it, that's cool as well.
Okay.
So first question, first true or false question is, in Crash Landing on You, and this one wasn't from the internet, this is really from my own memory. There's a scene when the, I don't know his name, the handsome guy, like the general guy that like, mm-hmm. you know, big and tall and whatever his name is, he drives a car to the Pyongyang, and like, because he has like special license plate, he's given like the ability to drive through red lights or something like that. He's just like, wow, this is the car of a XYZ important person because it has like certain numbers or certain numerals on the license plate. Is that true?
I don't know to the extent of like what you can do with certain license plates, but it's definitely true that your license plates determines how important you are, or what it also shows you what kind of car you are. Are you a private car? Are you a car for an NGO? Are you a government car? Are you a military car? Stuff like that. Mm-hmm. One of the most important plates that you'll find is the numbers, and those are in colors, okay? And I can't mm-hmm. remember the colors off the top of my head, so I won't go over them now. One of the most important plates in terms of numbers is if you have a 727. 727 is an important number in North Korea because the 27th of the 7th is Liberation Day in North Korea. So you'll see a lot of things. Their most expensive cigarettes are called 727s. And yeah, if you have a car with a license plate on 727, then you're an important person. But I'm sure mm-hmm. that there are also more important ones. I don't know what power it gives you, but for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I guess that's true. Second thing that I've... Now, everything else will be plugged off the internet. Apparently, there's only a certain number of haircuts that are allowed if you're a male or female. So, like, for example, you might not be allowed to get a buzz cut, or you might not be allowed to get a mohawk or something like that. Is that true? Or is that just like a cultural expectation that you know, you don't deviate, but it's not politically enforced? So, yeah, have you heard about the haircut enforcement rules?
Yes, and I would say that's false. Because it is more of like a cultural expectation thing. You're expected to not dye your hair crazy colors and stuff like that. And so, but I think this stems from like people seeing those pictures up in hairdressers of like example hairstyles and stuff. And I think like people are like, oh my God, they can only get these haircuts. And I'm like, when you go to any hairdressers, mm-hmm. what do you see all around you? Example haircuts. That's literally mm-hmm. just what that is.
So have you seen anyone with like dreadlocks or something in North Korea? Like, what's the craziest haircut you've seen in North Korean rock?
There wouldn't be. It is a very the society has a lot of rules, and whilst I say like there's no rules on the haircut, there are cultural expectations. So you know, if your haircut was too crazy, you would be stopped by the fashion police. That's not their official title. You would be mm-hmm. stopped by them and probably told like, hey, maybe do your hair differently next time.
What is that, an actual like it might not be called fashion police, or is that just like grandmas walking around like, hey, you look like an idiot? Or is that like an actual position?
There are actual people. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Next one. This, I'm not sure if you can really testify to this because it involves like statistics, but it says that only 3% of roads are paved in North Korea. Do you think that's like reasonable, or do you think that's like, you know, a little too high, a little too low? What do you think about that number?
That's so tricky to know, because you mean paved like not tarmac, or paved like so they have a pavement next to them?
No, as in like paved for cars to drive on.
I don't know.
Do you think that number is, now, once again, this is all guesswork at this point, because you don't have the ministry numbers, but do you think that's because I think you've been to like the rural areas of North Korea. Is it generally unpaved? Is it generally dirt roads? Like, what are the roads like?
The problem is the roads that I'm traveling on are all paved because I'm traveling in a bus. So, I would say, you know, it would be the opposite. Like, all of the roads that I've seen in North Korea have been paved. Looking out the window, maybe you see some roads that are unpaved. But yeah, mm-hmm. So on my knowledge, I would have to say, like, no, that's not true.
This is something else I found on the internet, which I was somewhat shocked by. But apparently blue jeans are not allowed because they're too American-centric. Is that true?
Yes, I would say generally... they're not allowed. You would never see North Koreans wearing jeans.
Not allowed or not socially acceptable?
I think it's not socially acceptable to the point at which it's not allowed.
Okay.
So, yeah. Okay, yeah. Like, it's not a rule written in their, you know, written in uh-huh. their laws, but, like, I think that you would be told to not wear them if you were wearing them.
Okay. And it would also be... it's like walking around naked in like Taiwan or something. It's like,
yeah,
like, it's like, it's so culturally offensive or something. Don't do that.
Yeah. And it would be like, where did you get those from? Like, obviously you've got like some kind of channel for foreign imports and stuff like that. It's just uh-huh. not something that you want to draw your attention to like that.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that would be true. Now,
yes.
The other thing I found on the internet was mm-hmm. that earrings similar to blue jeans, they're too American centric, Western centric. Are they allowed? Do you see North Koreans with earrings?
I think so, yeah. And also things like that are coming in much more. So, for example, plastic surgery, dyeing your hair.
Plastic surgery in North Korea?
Yeah, it's a thing.
Oh no, South Korea is winning the cultural war.
yeah. So it's not a big thing, but it is coming into the country. These things where, you know, women like to express themselves in these ways. And I think whilst they're not dyeing their hair crazy colours, maybe they're dyeing it like a little bit lighter brown or like anything that mm-hmm. they can get away with that doesn't look like their mm-hmm. hair is dyed. Mm-hmm. Plastic surgery, the same. The most common one is the eyelid thing.
Okay, so to the earring
one, I would belief, say
that's a false.
Yeah, that's false. I think so. Have you ever seen men with earrings or just women? And tattoos, they're only culturally accepted like in terms of like the army. So you'll see like some guys with like tattoos, and I'm not talking about like elaborate tattoos. I'm talking about like maybe something on their hand, I don't know, some mm-hmm. dumb star mm-hmm. or something.
This is something I saw on the internet a few months ago, and I was like, wow, is this true or is this not true? I guess I can ask you. But apparently the term, I hope I'm saying this right, oppa is like basically an affectionate term, mm-hmm. a term in South Korea for like a romantic partner, like an older male or something like that. Apparently the North Korean government didn't like their citizens using that term because it meant they were exposed to like, you know, Crash Landing on You or like other South Korean dramas. Is that true? That has been either a hard crackdown or soft crackdown on that word as a term of affection compared to like, I don't know, comrade or something like that. I'm not really sure what they would say. Is that true?
They call people Dongji and Dongmu in North Korea, and that translates to comrade, either someone higher up than you or somewhere lower than you.
Would you call your romantic partner that term? Or like, I don't know, is there like...
No. It's more of like a mister, you know? Like it's a term of respect. So it's very different to oppa in that respect. But also, I feel like in South Korea, it's not just your romantic partner that you can call oppa. I thought it was more of like a, it sounds kind of cute. Maybe it is just a romantic partner thing, but in North Korea, no one says that. It sounds very too personal. And I think in the North Korean language in general, compared to the South Korean language, it's very, indirect. So in mm-hmm. North Korea, they use a lot more polite form when mm-hmm. South Korea would not. The North Korea, so I do know that in North Korea, you have to watch, if you watch a lot of South Korean dramas and then obviously start getting this vocabulary into your system, then you do have to watch what you're saying because people can pick up on it and people can know, okay, maybe you're watching South Korean dramas. And then that mm-hmm. can become a bit of an issue. Whether it's exactly the word oppa or just other South Koreanisms, I can't say. But yeah, I guess I would say kind of true then.
Mm-hmm. But have you ever heard of like a, that's like a general like, don't use South Korean terms. Have you ever heard of any rule or any expectation to not use that word oppa in particular?
No.
Okay. Okay. But generally, there is, like, you know, don't use South Korean terms because that may mean you have a channel to South Korea. Yeah.
And I've joked around with the North Koreans saying the word oppa, you know, like, we'll joke around and say, like, oh, are you going to call him oppa and stuff like that? Like, it's not as if it's completely banned in the society. It's just not a cultural thing that they would use, I guess.
Other piece of information I got on the internet is that there are three and only three television channels in North Korea. Is that true or untrue?
That's untrue. I did have a list of all of the channels that they had because I think they started having new channels. But they do have, I think they started to have new channels in the past few years. It may have been true at one point. And I think that's where a lot of these myths come from, is that at one point they were true. You know, for example, at one point you weren't allowed to bring in your phone and you are now. So at one point it was true. They have more channels now.
Mm-hmm. So I guess currently untrue for the three channel belief. Is the calendar in North Korea based on Kim Il-sung? So whilst, like, in the West, it would be based on the Gregorian calendar. Is it based on, like, I heard that, once again, I'm not sure if this is true, but, like, the North Korean calendar would be like, oh, this is when he was born. And then, like, ever since then, it's like plus one, plus one, plus one. Is that true?
Yes, it's true to the extent that also, for example, Japan does this in terms of their emperor, right? They have two year systems. And also Taiwan as well. Taiwan does this.
Taiwan, yeah. Really? Since the...
year 112 now.
Yes, that I actually saw that when I was in Taiwan. Yeah, yeah. That's since the founding of the Republic of China, is that
exactly
correct?
Yeah. And so that's the same for North Korea. They use it in the same kind of context, like they have it there, and some of the things will be written in that year, but they also all know the Gregorian calendar, you know, this year's 2023 kind of thing.
Wow, that's really good context, because when I first saw that, I'm like, wow, like, the calendar system is based on, you know, the Kim family, but then you're like, oh, Taiwan does that as well. I'm like, oh yeah, that's
yeah,
good context.
Exactly.
I'm not sure if this is true. I'm not sure if you're actually able to answer this, but I've read on the internet that there are elections held in North Korea, except it's just a piece of paper with a single, I guess, option. Is that true? You probably haven't been around for one of those elections, if that is even true in the first place. But yeah, is that true? Is that false? Are you able to speak about that?
That's false, because they do have different parties in North Korea. There will be options for different parties. But whether people can actually select these parties or actually ever do, or the legitimacy of these elections, is something, you know, that I'll leave to the listener's imagination. But it's not true that it's just one... you know, one selection on the paper, because there are actually different active parties in North Korea.
The next one I read on the internet is that the power cuts occur quite frequently in order to save electricity. So maybe after 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock at night, power gets cut. Is that true or not true?
In some places, the power will go out of an evening, especially in the countryside areas. In Pyongyang, it generally stays on all night, but you will have power outages, especially in the winter. Sometimes you'll have power outages. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that's not government mandate. That's just like we ran out of electricity, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Next one. This, once again, this might be similar to the television question I had previously about whether or not this is dated or whether or not this is current, but only 28 websites are available and accessible in North Korea.
I have no idea about that one, because I don't know what websites are available to access in North Korea, because, and also, do you mean foreign websites or North Korean websites? Because actually North Korea has an intranet, it has an internal web system, which means that they can't access any foreign outlets. So I suppose you mean North Korean websites.
I guess so.
Yeah. And from that, I don't know how many there are, but they are only available to access North Korean websites, because that's how the intranet, internal internet works.
So I guess with the 28 website, Not really sure. Like, there is an intranet, but like, it could be 55, it could be one, it could be, you know, any number.
Exactly.
Is cannabis, now I'm not sure if this is true or not, I got this all from the internet, is it legal? It said it was legal in North Korea.
It's not. I don't know the exact rules that it says on it. I guess this comes from the fact that it grows in some of the locations, like hemp. You can buy hemp. Mm-hmm. Hemp is legal. Cannabis, I don't know the laws on it, but it's not legal.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so thank you for clearing that up. That was really interesting to like get this information off the internet and then actually compare it and throw it to someone who's actually been in the country. So can I ask, what is next for you? And, you know, you can plug your YouTube, you can plug whatever you want. Like, do you plan to, you said you plan to work, keep working for the North Korean tourism sector. So like, do you plan to stay in Taiwan until then? Like, what is the future? What does it consist of for yourself?
Yeah, it's a good question. I wish I knew. No, my plan in general at the moment is, so basically I am in Taiwan to do my PhD, so I'll be here for the next 3 or 4 years. But during that time, I do hope that North Korea opens up for tourism, and I will definitely be going back there. So until then, all I can do is continue to produce content. I've been behind on YouTube videos, but I still do try and do them once a week. So I will have some more Taiwan content coming out next week. But hope to also throw in some North Korea stuff too. I'm keeping up with like doing things on TikTok and Instagram and stuff like that. And then I've also just started my new podcast. So I don't know if your listeners want to try out something new as well, but you can head over to the podcast at Zoe. It's Discover North Korea. Everything else is Zoe Discovers, but Discover North Korea is my podcast. And I'll hopefully keep that up. I'm enjoying it at the moment, but. Yeah, my plan is to go back working in North Korea once it opens from COVID. Yeah, hopefully end of this year, next year, who knows?
Thank you for, you know, like clearing up a lot of the, you know, confirming and clearing up some of the ideas we from the outside have. But yeah, it was really informative and yeah, good luck and catch you soon.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for tuning into Safety Last with Stanley Ching. If you enjoyed this, then please leave a rating or a comment. I hope you're leaving with a new idea, and make sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and other places that can be found in the description.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, parental controls, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.